It's Wednesday, February 13th, 2008, and you're listening to episode 90 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 1 minute. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Luke.
My name is Matt.
And my name is Dex.
Why, Luke, are you laughing? Just so we can get some context to the listeners.
I don't even know. Everybody said you made a joke that you found funny, and I'm completely confused. Everybody gave that look.
We said this time we're going to start for real. And Matt made some comment about for reals, which are a brand of toy that's kind of popular right now. And I have two for reals spelled F-U-R-R-E-A-L-S.
I was thinking some sort of different toy. I'm like, What are you doing?
They're like,
it's a real furry.
They're like these little robotic animals that, like, you can get cats and stuff or whatever. And
no wonder Pearl is so nice. She's a robot.
Yeah, Pearl's an android or a dog droid or whatever the heck that would be.
Canine companion unit.
No, I have two for reals upstairs. I have a cat and Carla just bought a lamb. Before we get into even the announcements today,
a pre-announcement announcement.
Yeah, well, we have to do an important public service announcement.
Oh, yes, we do.
Because we haven't done one of these in a while. And guys, this is something that you need to be aware of. Ladies, if you're listening, you need to keep this in mind. And guys, you need to pass this along to your ladies, because if they truly love you, ask them the following question. Would you want me to die of cancer? And you can say that to your wife, or if ladies, you're listening, think for a minute. Would you want your man to die of cancer? And I would hope that unless you're a complete and utter bitch, the answer to this is, of course, no.
Let's hope.
And so we would like to inform you that there's a health study that actually came out a couple months ago, but it's just now making its way to Fear the Boot. And Luke is our resident pseudo doctor.
I'm a real doctor.
Or faux doctor, whatever.
I'm an OD. If there's a doctorate in there.
Dude, there's lots of people in the clinic that have ODs as well.
I am a real doctor. Leave me alone.
You endorse this, right?
My name is Dr. Meyer, and I endorse this message.
All right. There is an important study that came out a couple months ago that shows that your risk of prostate cancer in a male is directly linked. There's a perfect correlation to how often you have ejaculations. So, ladies, unless you want your man to die of cancer, you have a job, and I think you know what that job is. Guys, if you have a wife who loves you enough that she doesn't want you to die of cancer, we will link the study in the show notes. You need to pass this along to her and say, look, if you loved me, you would be engaging in certain activities more often to protect me from the very real health risk of prostate cancer.
I believe Matt made a snake analogy that was perfect earlier.
Well, yes, indeed. If you had, let's say, a poisonous reptile in your house, you wouldn't want it to be full of venom all the time where it could come around and bite someone.
Right.
No, you'd want to milk out that venom so it would be a venomless snake as much of the time as possible.
And in this case, it's like cancerous venom, but it's still venom nonetheless.
I don't think I can write a prescription for this. It would be respected by anybody, but I might try when I go home.
But if somebody's wife would actually follow it, then I'm sure you probably could make small cottage industry out of writing this prescription.
I wonder if the Missouri Bureau would allow that, if that's under my schedule. I can do up to schedule 2 drugs, and I never need to. Oh, yeah, I just never need to, because what would I need to prescribe schedule 2 for?
I wonder what a good hard bang is in terms of the narcotic schedule.
I don't know.
Anyway, before we lose our rating here, Fear the Con still coming up on March 8th.
We are still getting our pre-reg list. We've broke 70, which is good. And then we've got a ton of games. I mean, it's going to be a blast. And we've got a lot of prize support now, too. Hopefully enough for every Game Master. Otherwise, we'll arm wrestle for it. It'll be good.
And also, Chad and I are going to be going about the city this coming week. Now, my schedule is getting a little more sane again and hanging up some flyers. But they say, we've been told by people at Plan Cons, that you should expect a many-to-one ratio of your pre-reg to actual attendees.
Let's hope that's right.
So, yeah, if that turns out right, we'll have a really good con. If you've not pre-registered for Fear of the Con, check the show notes for the link. Please do. We would love to have you out there. Tony Mass, Fear the Fruit, which we will link to once again.
And let me reiterate one more time that I'm still taking GMs, probably up until mid-February. If you want to run a game, get me the info, because even if the pre-reg people don't fill it up, there'll be plenty of people at the con to play in your game.
Also, two reminders about Fear of the Con that we have not mentioned a couple episodes. The Friday night before Fear of the Con, since Fear of the Con is on Saturday, March 8th, we are going to have a worldwide wing night at a location that is going to be, we're looking at Side Pockets, which is a place that's really close to the hotel we're recommending.
It's in what we call around here the Man Mall.
And yeah, because it has a great big Bass Pro Shop and
Harley store.
Harley store and all that. But
in the safe store.
But
true.
Also, on top of that, the Sunday following Fear of the Con.
It's post-con eye exam.
It is post-con eye exam.
Included in their ticket price is a discounted eye exam for those of you who do not have insurance or have not had good health care anytime soon. I will be doing full eye exams. I probably won't be selling any glasses or contacts because I will not have any support staff with me unless we could work something out. But I will be doing exams, and your ticket price does get you a discount on those, a pretty large one at that. So I will have a sign up at the con for those interested. But I tell you what. If you go to the con and you sign up for that Sunday morning for an exam, and I come, open the whole office up, wake up early, and you don't come, I am hunting you down.
All right. Now, I'm saying right now that I cannot come real early on Sunday morning because I have a class that I teach from 9:30 to 10:30.
Oh, I'm not going to be up that early.
But, yeah, neither. I wish I wasn't either. But I am right now putting myself down as the first sign up because what happened previously was I went to a local eye care center that I couldn't stand. And they required an eye exam every year. So what I would
do... That's actually kind of the standard.
Right. And because I hated the place, what I would do is, within the first year, they'd sell me as many contacts as I wanted. I had monthly wear.
Don't tell people how to do this if they haven't figured it out. Well, this is the bane of every optometrist everywhere.
The point is that I would buy these, like, post-apocalyptic supply caches of contact lenses that would last me for years. But I'm about to run out. So I have.
Boy, it's odd you don't know any optometrists who could take care of you.
Well, I'm going to go on the air right now and volunteer that I will be the first sign up, that I am going to be at Meyer Eye Care the Sunday following Fear the Con. I will be in there to get that eye exam. And in my case, I'll be following up with you to actually buy the contacts.
Excellent.
Because I'm running out.
Well, and
so.
Then afterwards, too, there are plenty of places to eat around there. I figure if we get done around lunchtime, anybody who's sticking around, we'll go have lunch and send you on your merry way.
So if you want to hang out with the Fear of the Boot crowd a little bit longer.
Or unless you're sick of us by then.
Or you just have screwed up eyes in general. And now one of the things that has really attracted me to Meyer Eye Care is
this would be good.
The thing that I cannot stand about most eye exam places, outside of the fact the last optometrist I had was a pushy jackass, is, of course, the glaucoma test.
I will not do the puff on you.
And
I
Luke,
will do the Goldman.
I hate the puff test where they puff that damn blast of air into your eye.
You pansy.
And now, but before you get done insulting me, Luke, why don't you tell them about the glaucoma test machine that you have?
Well, it's not just me. Everybody who has that puff should have what's called a Goldman tonometer, which is actually the gold standard of tonometry, which measures pressure, which you just put some drops in, you numb the eye, and there's no puff of air, there's no surprise. It's easy. You may feel a little tickle on your eyelashes, but that's about it. And so, it's actually a better read, and the only reason people don't do it is because it requires some drops, and the techs can't do it. And all doctors love to have their techs do as many things as possible.
Right. So if you're like me and you've been avoiding eye care because you hate that damn glaucoma test, with Meyer Eye Care, you have no excuse. So sign up and come out there for that eye exam the next day.
One of the many reasons you don't have any excuse.
Well, you know, between the eye care and the testicle health warnings, sounds like Fear the Con is going to almost be like a little health fair.
Well, you got Fear the Fruit going on,
and
too.
And the nutritional supplements.
Oh, Fear the Fruit, additional sex, eye exams. I mean...
Let's see if we get sponsored by the American Heart
Association.
And I've
got an idea for a mod that involves these poisonous snakes.
That need to be milked. My milking is...
No, you're going to give away the plot.
So you're one of my patients. I haven't seen you in a while. Actually, you're overdue, I think.
If you're going to milk a snake, I don't want to know about this. All right, Luke. You've got a little bit of a game review of sorts for us.
No, it's not a game review. It's a Luke's Mad review.
And I'm going to let you do this review because what you wrote on the big board in our notes is Black Industries, which sounds like we're about to start a racist tirade. So
yeah, it sounds exactly like that.
Before we actually end up there, Why don't you explain what this is actually about?
Ladies and gentlemen, you all have heard us talk about Games Workshop and the fact that we all feel like it's like that girlfriend who's fun to hang out with, but when once it starts to get hot and heavy, she'll kick you in the nuts. That happens with every game Game Workshop puts out, except for Fantasy Battle and 40K. We'll even do with that. We all stopped playing because our armies didn't get supported. So a bunch of us went to their smaller games like Mordheim and Necromunda and Gorkamork and had a grand old time.
Or War Machine.
Or, well, that's not Games Workshop.
Oh, I know.
But we were playing GW games. All those specialist games were phenomenal and were promptly canceled. Although you can get them for free online now through their website, which is actually kind of cool. So, I've already had it with GW. I've had it for years, but they finally brought around the role-playing sector, the role-playing design studio again. Black Industries came around and revised Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay a few years
back.
Which
I've heard, Warhammer Fantasy role-playing game, mm-hmm. I've never personally picked it up. I have thumbed through the books, mm-hmm. but I've had that recommended to me by a lot of people.
If you want
to
borrow them, I own a good portion of that line because I played first edition and I loved it.
That's what I've heard is Warhammer Fantasy, the first run, was an excellent, outstanding
second edition
game.
Topped it. It's all the same dark humor and great, unique gameplay, but it's in a much better package. The production values are stellar. It's an amazing production and a great game.
Okay,
That's awesome. I love Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, although I've never got a chance to play it. Now, after years of people talking, we need a 40K RPG. We need one. It's going to be awesome. Black Industries says, we're going to make one. We're actually going to make three. We're going to have one focusing on Inquisitors and their retinue, one focusing on like Space Marines and blah, 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 and one focusing on aliens. So they'll all be compatible, but no one book can cover all these in the depth we need.
Okay.
It's called Dark Heresy. At least the first book is. Everybody's excited as can be. So, release date's coming. It was supposed to be February, March.
So their model here is basically to follow White Wolf's Noun the Gerundene.
Kind of.
Okay.
But it's everybody's getting real excited because Dark Heresy was coming out last month. So it releases. They immediately announce that they are completely sold out based on pre-orders alone. That they cannot order off their website. If you find the bookstore, buy it because this is it. Then they immediately announce they're closing their doors. It's like
handy
because GW decided they're not profitable enough because their novel division is basically printing money. That's why. And the role-playing division just got canceled because of it pretty much. And it sucks. And it's completely monetary. And it's just another way GW kicks you in the balls because I picked up Dark Heresy today and it is one of the coolest role-playing books I've picked up in years.
Isn't it actually kind of tied into the novels?
Yeah, well, it is. But the novels are... the overhead on writing a novel is a lot less than writing a role-playing game.
Right.
And a lot more people buy them.
You have one author to shaft instead of many authors.
Exactly. And artists and all kinds of stuff. Right. So, I mean, it's just ridiculous. And I'm very upset again. I don't know why I even buy anything, GW. You think I would have learned my lesson by now. If I like it, I'm going to get kicked in the nuts. GW, that should be their slogan. We're going to kick you in the nuts.
Unless you're the Bretonians.
With some weird English spelling. That's what it should be. Rant over. That's all I have to say about Black Industries. But come on. We made a successful role-playing game. It's sold out on the first day.
This is not the first time I've seen this, though. And I've never seen this at the corporate level. The dumbest thing I've ever been told in my entire life, I was working for an insurance company, and this stands as the number one dumbest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. I was responsible for setting up a database thing to pick up online insurance quotes.
Mm-hmm.
And the senior vice president of marketing walked over to me, says to me, Dan, our online website stuff is generating too much business, so I need you to turn it off. Turns around and walks away. this takes the cake as the number one dumbest thing I have ever heard anyone say in non-just in my entire life. But I have seen a lot of small, like, friendly local gaming stores. Like, I can remember when Magic first hit, and that was the thing that nobody could keep it in stock. This stuff was selling like
Wheeze.
Like crack at a whorehouse. And I remember talking to a guy who ran a gaming shop who's like, well, I'm not going to carry it just for some personal principle that he hated the game. I'm like... dumbass.
How much longer did he have a game shop after that?
I don't know, but it's like, dumbass, the purpose of your store is to make money. The purpose of this podcast is to rant and rave about what we love and hate. Because
I'm looking at you, GW.
But we make no money off of it. You know, we're an editorial show. But the purpose of a damned store is to sell things. And when people are coming in saying, hey, look at this. I've got money, probably mom's money, but nonetheless, I've got money and I want to buy these decks of cards. And you're like, no. Harum, harum, I'm too good to carry them.
You know that guy.
You are what scientists call a moron.
Well, you know, that's a guy who wanted to own a record store and be snooty, but he wasn't cool enough. So he opened up the gaming store. It's like, this is what I know. And I'm not going to. The only game I'm going to carry is Chivalry and Sorcery. So screw you guys.
So.
Or Tales of the Floating Vagabond, Mr. I'm going to make an obscure game reference just so I sound cool.
Hey. We didn't play it for that long, but I had more fun playing that silly game than, well, it was a good time.
All right. At least you didn't say Metamorphosis Alpha or Sky Realms of Jeroen or Fatal.
Then I would just being pretentious.
Yeah, then you'd be pretentious. All
Dax,
right.
I see you on the webcam looking utterly perplexed and occasionally rolling your eyes.
Well, I just really haven't had a whole lot to add to the discourse.
You played Fantasy Battle. You should be able to rant on GW just like everybody else.
Oh, no, I am. I mean, I spent tons and tons and tons of time and money purchasing and assembling and painting miniatures that are now obsolete or no longer supported. Uh-huh. And I have all sorts of stuff that I can't possibly use. And I gave it all to the neighbor kid because I realized that now as an adult, there's no possible way I could keep up with that treadmill.
Oh, you'd be surprised.
Yeah, at least a little kitty can chew on them.
I think he said kid, not kitty.
Well, the kid can still chew on him. I mean,
because he can too.
Chewing's an any age
good thing
activity.
Good thing they're not lead-based anymore,
I've
Dan.
Got some Chaos Space Marines in that little tub right there. I mean, I could be chewing on those during the podcast.
Some people chew on sticks. Some
well,
people
I
chew on
keeping
straw.
Some of my stuff, just like there were some models that I painted that I thought looked really nice. So I've kept maybe 24 various sundry miniatures that I just kind of display.
That's enough for
no
Mordheim Warband.
Well, I have to say here, Tex, to your credit. Now, granted, it's been a couple years since I've seen any of your painted minis, mostly because when you come back to St. Louis to visit, it's usually not minis you have in your suitcase. But I got to say, back in the day, you were a damn fine mini painter. I mean, I remember looking really appreciatively at some of the things you did, like with your Space Marine captain, where you got down to like the jewelry he was wearing. I mean, you had each individual gem painted a different color. So I got to say, if you kept some of your pieces surely for their artistic value, you know, I'm going to give you the little bit of props or I don't know if this is some kind of incestual fellation here or what this is.
It all comes back to that.
That'll reduce your cancer risk too. But, you know,
well, any way you can
yeah,
get
I'm helping out my brother here, protecting him from prostate cancer.
Oh, wow. Over interstate lines.
Oh, by the way, Luke, I did also play Necromunda. And I did use Necromunda sort of as a GW gateway drug.
Yeah, it was, because Necromunda and Mordheim are great.
I love Necromunda.
In fact,
Necromunda.
It was a wonderful gateway drug until they destroyed all that, because you could actually use the Necromunda models, because a lot of their gangs were modeled after the 40K armies, to actually start like an Imperial Guard or even a Gene Stealer cult army.
Well, yeah,
but then they discontinued the Gene Stealer cult, so then all that stuff was obsolete.
Well, I'll say that's what I played in Necromunda. I played two armies. One, I can't think what their name was, but they're like a tech army where like they were all bald and had like these like sensor glasses on. I can't think what they were called. But the other thing that I played was the Gene Stealer cult. And of course, like my pure strain was 75% of my point value. But nonetheless, I really enjoyed playing it. And then, of course, they stopped supporting that. Like they do everything they come up with, it's good.
All their good stuff, yeah.
Or one of their best gateway drugs, Blood Bowl.
Oh, Blood Bowl was fun.
I had a couple friends in college where, like, there were a couple different fraternities where, like, they weren't really filled with gamers, but they each had these giant, long, protracted Blood Bowl tournaments that, you know.
That's the same way we did Mordheim campaigns.
Did I tell you guys about the one time we played Warhammer Fantasy Battle in my fraternity house?
No.
So one of the guys I played with in college lived in an apartment. And we normally played at the local friendly gaming shop, but for whatever reason, some night that wasn't available. And so he came over and we pulled a couple of tables together and we set up in the chapter room of the fraternity, which was maybe from the door to the end of the room where we were set up was maybe 40 or 50 feet. I mean, it's a pretty darn good sized room.
Okay.
And the wizards in Warhammer Fantasy Battles would come with a little familiar miniature, like a little half sized thing, you know, and they would be, you know, like a little pumpkin man or a little ghost or, you know, things like that. Well, one of the familiars that he got was actually a seductive looking female. I don't remember exactly what it was supposed to be.
Bet you
it wasn't painted. And so we're sitting at the far end of the room on the table playing, and he's got this little miniature out, and the thing stands maybe, I don't know, half an inch tall. And one of my fraternity brothers walks through the door at the opposite end of the room, 50 feet away, spots this half inch tall, unpainted miniature and goes, "Ooh, a naked chick."
Wow.
By the way, that was mixed in with the like 100 other miniatures we had on the table.
Hey, Tex, did you go to UMR by chance?
Yeah, actually, I did.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Well, Tex, what was your saying at UMR about women?
Oh, said that UMR, pound for pound, we had as many women as any other school.
See, I've got I've heard from several people who went to engineering schools. There's a whole ton of those jokes. There's Rose Holman. There's not a lot of women here, but there's a ton of them. same joke, pretty much.
Yeah.
Well, no, I didn't go to it, but apparently one year Kappa Sigma had a no fat chicks party. And they actually got a couple of 2x4s and they nailed them up in a doorway. And the deal was you couldn't come into the party unless you could fit between the 2x4s.
Wow.
I didn't go, but I've heard there were some people that were rather desperately trying to fit between the 2x4s.
Wow. The other side of that for women who go to engineering schools, it's you say about the men that the odds are good, but the goods are odd.
I know whenever my sister came down, she really enjoyed herself.
I bet so. It's Sausage Fest 2000.
My sister went down to UMR, but being my sister, this is as far as I want to know anything. So, all righty, let's get on to some actual topics here, since previously these weren't actual topics, and that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. But I said it anyway, so we're going to go with it. Because whatever we say on Fear the Boot is true.
Exactly. It's Fear the Boot.
Yeah.
If it's on the internet, it must be true.
Exactly. All right. Tex, you had something you want to talk about today. You laid it out. In general terms, this is a topic that other podcasts have hit, but we have never talked about on Fear the Boot. In fact, I'm going to give a plug to Mick Bradley and his podcast, like House of the Harping Monkey and such, where he has shows that are dedicated to this topic. But we have never once really tackled it on Fear the Boot. And Tex suggested that we take it on just for one episode, which is classic storytelling, but really the way he laid it out is what is more popularly known as the hero's journey. And Tex, I was wondering if you could lay out for us what kind of the steps are that you researched to this hero's journey, quote unquote, and how that relates to role-playing games.
Okay, well, there's a few variations on this. But a lot of this is based on a book that was published by Joseph Campbell a while ago, and the History Channel even touched on it too. And one of the basic premises is, because I have a coworker who was a theater major, said that, I can't remember the exact number, but there's only a finite number of stories in the world. And it's a very small number. It's something like 7 or 8 or 12, something like that.
Okay.
And that basically every story that's ever told, be it either in print or in film or orally or in a video game, is going to follow one of these small number of basic plots.
Okay.
And the thing is that they're used over and over because they work and they work well. And so what I was thinking about is there are examples in print, for example, the David Eddings Belgariad books or The Hobbit, to a slightly lesser degree, the Lord of the Rings series. And also in film, I could think of like The Wizard of Oz. I could think of The Matrix. I could think of the first Star Wars, well, episode 4 Star Wars. And then also in video games, some of your Final Fantasy games, Mass Effect is a more recent one.
I refuse to believe that Final Fantasy has any kind of plot.
Basic formula. I'm sorry?
I said I refuse to believe that any Final Fantasy game has any sort of plot or redeeming value.
I refuse to believe that the theater major has a job.
Anyway, I bring this up for two reasons. I don't have a shotgun right now. Go on, though.
Well, I bring this up for two reasons. One, we've given a lot of GM advice for how to construct a party and how to manage the group and how to do the group template and such, but we haven't given a whole lot of advice on actual plot writing. And I hate to recommend plagiarism, but if you plagiarize this basic macroscopic template, it works for every adventure story. And the other thing is, I've had a number of people ask on the forums about how to handle female gamers or female protagonists.
Okay.
And so I was going to bring up like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Wizard of Oz and Alice in Wonderland, both the book and the movie, because all three of these are cases where you have either a female protagonist or you have females in the protagonist group, and they can give you an idea of how to do the same basic model, the same basic adventure story. But for example, with The Wizard of Oz or with Alice in Wonderland, it's not so combat heavy. But so you can have a female protagonist go through the same basic hero's journey, though.
You'd have the same thing in Mass Effect if you're smart enough to get the lesbian sex scene.
Booyah!
Or if you've ever The Deed of Pax Singarian by Elizabeth Moon. Very strong female.
So anyway, the first step in the hero's journey is you start off in the ordinary world and you have what's called the call to adventure. And the reason you have to do this is you have to have something that the audience can relate to or that the reader can listen to. That they say, okay, that could be me. I can relate to this character. So, for example, in The Matrix, you've got Neo starting off working for the man in a cubicle. Or in Star Wars, you've got Luke Skywalker working on a farm for his aunt and uncle. Or you've got The Hobbit in the Shire. Or you've got the kids in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe that are bored, and they're just playing in this big house. So in the ordinary world, there's something you can relate to.
Or Unicron. And
the call to adventure is typically...
I guess that doesn't work. Come on. All right. You have
No, it really doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
Well, wait a minute. The little boy.
Well, I wouldn't really say Transformers the movie is a classic hero's tale.
No, I would not either. This is one thing that I wanted to...
I would say Transformers the movie is great characters and bad story.
Yeah, I would agree with
and
that.
And a good soundtrack.
You shut your mouth.
But, all right. Now, having said that, though, one of the things I want to interject here before we get too deep into this is I have heard some people, and I'm not talking about other podcasts here, I'm talking about mostly posters on sundry forums, not even necessarily our forums, but try to take this too far and say that effectively every story told can be boiled down to the hero's journey. And I do not agree with that. I think there are stories where they are different enough from the hero's journey that if you want to bring them back to the hero's journey, I mean, you're stretching so far.
Right. It's my understanding that there are a small number of basic stories, but the hero journey is one of them, but not the only one.
Right. Now, your statement that there might be 8 or 12 archetypical stories, like, may be true.
Hero's journey, Harlequin romance.
The tragedy, the comedy, the romance.
Harlequin.
But I'd have to see that list before I could comment on it either way. But all right, so we start off with, Tex, let's work through the steps of the hero's journey. But before, before we get into that, let's talk about how this applies to a role-playing game.
See, I was about to throw in here that I already don't like this as a plot-generating device, because for the steps you're having to take, you're railroading. If you're planning this whole thing out, you're not giving the PCs much choice. You have a... If you're doing a hero's journey, if you're following the steps, if you've got every spot already planned for, here's the redemption, here's this, you're making decisions before them.
Forgive me for interrupting, but I have to disagree that the hero's journey is a broad enough, macroscopic enough framework that you can still give the players a great deal of control within the framework.
On this one, I got to go with Tex, at least at this point in the conversation. Now, as Tex's thesis develops, I may diverge from him, but at the moment I'm gonna have to agree with him that I know when I sit down to write a role-playing game that I generally want this event to happen, and even though I may not know exactly how it's going to happen, I still have some idea of generally, it's if like they've got to learn about the bad guy's plot, even if you don't know precisely, railroading is to say, well, it's going to happen this way.
Well, look,
as opposed to a more open gaming format where you can say they're going to learn about it. And, it might happen through them talking to a crony or them intercepting a letter or them. You can kind of roll players
after school special.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not saying they're not useful, especially in individual chunks. I think they can be good for setting the theme, the mood of your adventure, what you want to accomplish if you look at these individual steps. But taken as a whole, I see too much forced action. I see them as they can be a decent guide, but you guys know that I run a more open game where I create the NPCs in the world and let the dominoes fall. I really
disagree on two points. One is that this has nothing to do with theme or setting. It's just a basic framework of any story, and that could be applied to a science fiction or a fantasy
If you're going to do a story like, say, the redemption or one of the further steps. That is a theme to a arc of the campaign right there. Is okay, the PCs have done something wrong, and they have to redeem themselves. Or,
but the redemption isn't necessarily part of the basic hero's journey. The redemption is one of the ways that you could do the ordeal.
Okay, well, name
but
another part of
the ordeal doesn't have to be
again.
A redemption, and it doesn't have to be a redemption of your father or anything like that.
You know, before we go any further, I know there's some people that are really into this kind of storytelling theory sort of thing. I said, Mick Bradley's podcast is dedicated to this. So, Tex, just for the sake of laying this out, would you mind giving us the steps of the hero's journey? And
yeah, because I think Luke's reading too much into this.
Well, all right, why don't you give us the steps of the hero's journey? And also,
I can't even read.
Was there a specific source that you pulled these steps from? Or was this just kind of general observations? Because
no,
like,
these are from a book written by Joseph Campbell, although it's been studied numerous times, and there's a lot of twists and variations to it. And there's also some sites that cover the NPC basic types too. You know, for example, the mentor, the scoundrel, the barbarian, the damsel in distress, things like that. But,
okay.
So let me go ahead and give you the basic steps.
All right, give us the steps.
Okay, so step one is the ordinary world.
Okay.
So
you're the vapor farmer or whatever. Okay, so right. So
right.
You're
and
living a boring
something,
life.
Is something that the audience can relate to.
Okay.
Okay, step two is the call to adventure. And the hero is either presented with a problem, or the hero may get a foreshadowing or a little warning or have a little scrape or something like that.
Okay, so Gandalf shows up and says, there's a ring you need to deal with.
Right. Step three is the refusal of the call. Now, in a role-playing game, this may not be appropriate, but you saw it like in The Matrix and you saw it in Star Wars, where the hero initially refused the journey and retreated back to the ordinary world.
Right. And of course, in a role-playing game, you can't control that because you don't know what the PCs are going to do. So,
okay, the next step is the meeting with the mentor. And so the hero is given a mentor, whether that be Belgarath the Sorcerer or whether that be from The Matrix, Lawrence Fishburne.
Morpheus.
Character. Morpheus, thank you. Obi-Wan Kenobi, or in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobes, even meeting the beavers. I mean, in that case, the beavers were the mentor.
This goes back to our PSA.
I'd go on a journey to meet some beaver.
Yeah, anyway. Okay, so the next step is what they call the crossing of the threshold. And sometimes there is a compulsion that compels the hero onto the journey. For example, in the video game Fable, you're a little kid and your hometown gets burned to the ground. So you have no choice. Or in Star Wars, when Luke goes back and he finds his aunt and uncle have been killed. Or in the, you know, there's something that compels you to the journey. And then you have what's called the crossing of the threshold. And the crossing of the threshold is the we're not in Kansas anymore moment.
Okay.
That's when you recognize, okay, I have left the ordinary world behind and now I am on this fantastic adventure. So either I'm in Oz and I just landed in the Munchkin Village, or I have just stepped through the wardrobe into Narnia, or I just took the red pill.
Okay.
Or in the case of Star Wars, the creature cantina is typically the crossing of the threshold moment where Luke steps into the cantina and it's full of this alien freak show.
But no droids.
Right. Okay. And then the next step is meeting of enemies and allies. So the hero is then typically introduced to his enemies and will also collect allies. Now, I won't go into those types of allies, but there's a whole subsection on what types of allies are typically in these stories.
Right. Because
and also what types of enemies, too.
Right. Because since they've just joined the adventure, up to this point, they were not part of that continuum of enemies and allies. And now suddenly they've taken a side.
Right.
So the, you know,
right. So if we have extra time, I can kind of cover the basic archetypes there, but we don't have to right now.
Right. Okay. But
the next step is the approach that the hero has a challenge, or the hero sets out to do something and then fails and has a setback. And typically in a story, this setback can be the lack of the hero's personal growth or the lack of the hero's character that the hero has to grow to. But even in a video game, it's not uncommon for you to, earlier in the game, meet the final bad guy and be beaten back by him, and for you to have to go grow strong and come
Garland's
back
Garland's that best.
Yeah, or the worst case scenario I can think of is Kefka, you know, like from Final... Yeah, where he shows up like 80... You have 85 fights with the guy before you finally get to kill him. Or every time he knocks you down to one hit point and then disappears, or you fight him and then he runs off or whatever, so... All right, so keep going.
So typically in there then is a period of growth or advancement, which then leads to the ordeal. And the ordeal is the final showdown. That's the attack on the Death Star. That's the final battle where they attack the Ice Queen in the Chronicles of Narnia, things like that. So the ordeal is the final climactic battle.
Okay.
Then typically there is the reward. And I don't want to confuse the reward with the gift. The gift is an optional step. And in many cases, the mentor will give the protagonist a gift. For example, your father's lightsaber or the ring.
Or now I know Kung Fu.
Right. And so in all those cases, that was the gift. Now, the gift is something that the mentor will typically give the protagonist to help them in the journey. Then there's the road back, which is the road back to the ordinary world, where typically the hero has to then leave the adventure behind and go back to the ordinary world. But now the hero has come back changed.
Now, at what point does the hero get his lucrative shoe contract?
Depends on which basketball
he's playing. I don't think that's one of the basic steps.
All right. Now, let me comment on this in regard to role-playing games. I'm going to comment on what I think is both its relevance and its irrelevance to role-playing games. The relevance that I think it has to role-playing games is that, first of all, if you are the type of GM that writes a plot versus a Luke or Chad type GM,
I'm not saying I prepare unlike Chad. All right, there's a difference.
The point
there.
Being though, I say Luke or Chad in the sense that with you, you kind of let the players direct the plot, as opposed to Chad where he just kind of lets whatever direct the plot, nothing direct the plot, you know, just whatever. And I think that with a GM who sits down to prepare a plot, that this is a formula you can use to outline the basic journey of a character. Because as we've said since we started this show, a role-playing game is fundamentally about the player characters. And so if you have player characters that start off as relatively ordinary people in the ordinary world, that they're just basic soldiers in an army or they're basic farmers in a village or whatever, that you can outline adventure around this. So I think that this can serve as a good general outline for an adventure. Now, of course, it lacks any of the specifics that would give a detail.
Right. For example, Luke was talking earlier about the redemption, and the redemption is one type of ordeal, but there are other ordeals besides redemptions.
I took them to a different place earlier. I did read too much into it. You're right. But I do have another comment on this when you're done.
All right. The irrelevance, I think, or where this gets difficult to apply to a role-playing game is the fact that unlike true storytelling, you don't have control over what the player character is going to do. That the player character can choose to ignore the mentor. The player character can choose
to... Or kill him.
Yeah. Or the player character can choose to have no interest in redeeming him or herself. That there's a certain degree of, I don't know, randomness or chaos to this because of the fact that unlike in general storytelling, whether we're talking about Star Wars or The Matrix or Lord of the Rings, you have ideally, once again, assuming you're not railroading, you have basically no control over what happens when the characters reach each of these points. That they could reach the mentor, and like you said, I mean, they might just take the gun and pop his head off.
Take this old man in the desert.
Yeah, exactly. For no particular reason, which, you hope that wouldn't happen. But the point is that you don't know. And I don't think personally you should railroad to the point that, you have to accept him as a mentor. Mm-hmm.
Dan, let me take it a little bit different direction. Rather than saying the hero's journey is something that you've got plotted out, that you have figured out what their journey is ahead of time. In this case, you might be able to kind of backfit the hero's journey.
This is where I come in.
You know, if you've got a series of branching paths, or if you have a little bit more open-ended game, it's not even paths, it's just,
it's a pool.
It's a pool.
It's a pool. Okay,
a pool of possibilities. Look, then at the end, you can kind of review and see, they kind of hit points A, B, and C, chose to completely ignore D and E, but then eventually they got around to F, and F is always very important.
Here's my take on this. The hero's journey was made to frame classic stories. This is Joseph Campbell drew all this stuff out of thousands, thousands of stories. That's where he came up with it all.
Right. Yeah.
It basically comes down to theory when it comes to writing. Obviously, role playing games are not a novel. They're not a book, as we've covered many, many times here. And I don't see this. This all comes down back to more role playing theory, which we've all talked about. How I feel is pretty much wankery. So I don't see the practical application of most of this while planning an adventure, kind of like Matt just said. However, it's easy to go back to what you've done, to look at the campaign as a whole and go, this fits with this. You know, this was this part of the journey. This was this part. You can backfit and describe, but to use it to try to create something, I don't see it as a good method to create something. It is just a general theory that can be applied to critique the story you've created. I don't think it's good for generating anything because it leads to a pretty standard outcome, even if it's different in...
Pretty good for generating backstory, though.
Yes, backstory would be a great way to do this.
Well, I guess...
Right, and typically the mentor character is a evolved hero or an evolved protagonist.
Charles Darwin.
So, for example, if you need to come up with a mentor character and you need to give the mentor character a backstory, the mentor is typically a protagonist that's been around the block, that's been down the path.
He's level 21. What more backstory do you need?
Backstory generator.
Well, I got to say that, you know, thinking back, that even though I did not set out to do this, probably the best D&D campaign I ever ran was a Forgotten Realms game that, in retrospect, did generally fit the hero's journey. And I don't know that I ever sat down to do that intentionally, because this was before I probably even knew the phrase hero's journey.
This is so inherent in storytelling. I mean, this is why it's become a standard framework, because so many people come to it, because it's interesting. It's something that keeps the story going.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it works, because even on some emotional level, I mean, let's face it, role-playing games on their basic level are some form of escape, that it's an opportunity to be someone, somewhere, whatever, other than what you are in reality. And I don't want to get caught up in whether these are all power fantasies or not, but the
point
being...
What if you always just play yourself like I do?
Well...
Sometimes I have an axe.
Then you're a pretty crappy player is what that comes down to.
I occasionally can fly. I'm like Dwight Schrute.
Perhaps you need to listen to some of our past episodes on character creation. But the point being that, you know, as you're setting out to create these characters, you can start with a character that you basically relate to, which is, let's be honest, 99.999% of the people listening to this show are people that have relatively mundane lives dealing with boring jobs and the crap that is typical to every human being in the world.
So Richard Branson doesn't ever need to play role-playing games.
And
he lives it.
Here we are at the start of the hero's journey, that if you want to play a character who's escaping the normal, what better place to start than with a character who is living the normal, but then suddenly you get an opportunity out.
You just blew my mind right there.
But, you know, of course, once you get that opportunity out, you've got to have someone to sort of be your guide into what this new reality is. And herein comes the mentor.
The game master. What are you saying?
I can think of, like, in that Forgotten Realms campaign, that the characters started out as they were all apprentices or low-level acolytes of whatever it is they were doing. They were squires to knights or entry-level acolytes into religious orders, whatever the case may have been. And strange things started happening. You know, here we have Texas Call to Adventure or whatever. And then along comes a mentor. And it wasn't per se that I had written out, oh, here comes the mentor. But there were people, in this case, multiple characters that entered in who were further down the path, who kind of had an understanding the characters didn't. Maybe they didn't have all the answers, but they could sort of point them in the right direction.
Wipe their nose a bit, them on the butt.
I am picturing here an actual gaming group taking on a new player. As you're saying this, and the game master is the mentor, and you got the evolved players along the way, and they go into their, they get their call to adventure when you make the characters and start playing.
Here's
it's a story
gamer.
Of a role-playing group telling a story that's a hero's journey, and it just blew my mind again!
Young geek to fat beard.
That's right.
The complete evolution.
fighting heart disease is your ordeal.
Well, remember, the role of the mentor is not to tell the characters what to do.
Which GMs do not.
Exactly. And so I'm not saying that the GM or the mentor should tell the characters do this next.
Can we start calling them the game mentor instead?
It's to lend experience. It's to give the characters sort of an educational resource, and as they're exploring into the unknown,
so,
to have someone who's been there.
So the mentor is Fear the Boot, and the GM is just another character.
All right, well,
in the story.
I think you're taking this to a level of metagaming that wasn't intended, but
I'm wanking so hard right now.
I know. For you're saving yourself from prostate cancer.
Prostate cancer is not touching me.
Prostate cancer, goodbye.
Goodbye.
As are my eyes.
But the point being that I see where Texas is coming from, that, you know, if you once again, don't make this analogy walk on all fours. If you take this for what it is, that there is kind of a useful outline here for creating an adventure. Now, the fear that I would have, and this is kind of the fear that, or this is one of the reasons why I'm not an avid reader of fantasy stories in general, is you can take this hero story and you can move it from a useful template into this restrictive, I wouldn't even say archetype, but stereotype, that suddenly every fantasy story becomes the same, that every, you know, and I, you could do this, forget fantasy, every, you could do this within role-playing games, a sci-fi story or whatever, that every story unintentionally becomes the same. And thinking back through the role-playing games that I've written and run, I can definitely, and I don't know what this list of 8 or 12 different story archetypes are that you have, but I can definitely come up with adventures I've run that do not fit this hero's journey. And I think if you take this too far, yeah, you've locked yourself into this.
Gaming becomes academia and nobody enjoys themselves.
Well, worse than academia, it becomes formulaic.
Oh, I don't know if that's worse.
On the other hand, if you're a struggling game master who's looking for a way to either, maybe you're a new GM and need to start your first game, or like as Luke suggested earlier, it's a great backstory generator. So if you need to introduce a NPC character that has a lot of background, there's a good way to do this with backstory.
It's a good solid template to start with. I mean, especially
Well, for example, one that's fresh on my mind is Mass Effect, the video game. And Mass Effect follows this formula, but I really, really enjoyed the story. And I know some of you did, too, because I've seen your gamer score.
Well, that would be me.
Yeah, some people play it on their fourth playthrough now.
I'm like on my fourth or fifth playthrough now.
Dang,
so.
I played it, played it through once, and I was happy.
Mass Effect follows this formula.
Yeah,
it's still a good story.
Well, I think video games and books and movies are trying to tell a very specific story, you'll follow that more often as opposed to a role-playing game where it's not one person in control of all the characters. Everybody does their own thing. That's what you mentioned earlier.
We could get into a whole bunch of subtopics here, but that's one of the big concerns is you do not have control over the player characters. If you do, in my opinion, you're running a bad game. But you don't have control of player characters. You don't know that when that call to adventure comes, they're going to respond. Or when that mentor shows up, they're going to give a damn.
Yeah, how many cloaked people in the end do they have to kill before they let finally one get through to give them the adventure?
Right. And, you know, I could come up with all kinds of subtopics here about how it is you make that mentor interesting to the person.
Oh, no, never getting into theory and my head's going to hurt.
I know. I don't want to get into that kind of tangent. But because we've talked about in the past designing interesting NPCs and tying players into the story and... So I don't think we need to rehash that right here and right now.
Basically, right here, pause it and go back and listen to all other episodes.
Yeah.
And restart.
If you didn't want to go too deep down that rabbit hole, then did you want me to start talking about just some of the other basic archetypes that are found in these stories?
Yeah, just
to keep it at a high level.
Yeah, just to keep it at a real high level. But yeah, out of curiosity, go ahead.
Okay, so another archetype is the donor. And sometimes the mentor is the donor, but it's the NPC that gives the hero a gift that helps the hero along his ways. For example, teaching Neo Kung Fu or giving Frodo the little magic dagger thing that he named.
Sting. Buying the newbie, his first set of dice.
Right. Or his father's lightsaber. So sometimes the mentor is the donor, but the donor can be somebody else that comes along and gives the character a gift.
Okay.
Then there is sometimes what's called the opposite. And the opposite is often a party member. But the ally is the hero's opposite in every way. So if the hero is male, the opposite is female. If the hero is sloppy, the opposite is neat. What? If it's to give the hero a counterbalance point of view. And so the opposite is there to, first off, to be the offset of the hero, to contrast the hero, but also to expose the hero to growth paths.
The opposite.
And so the hero can say, okay.
Is Bill.
Well, I see what you're saying, though. I mean, if you want to put this in much more pedestrian terms, you can take what in movies is known as the buddy story or the buddy formula, where you have two people. You've got the neat roommate and the sloppy roommate. And the point is that over time, what is it that our sisters are always watching? It's Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau movies.
Grumpy old men.
And, you know, where you have these two guys where, once again, I see what you're saying, Tex, that one exposes the other to a growth path because of the opposition or the dichotomy that you see between those two characters.
Right. Now, in a true buddy story, typically, both of them are protagonists and they discover the virtues of each other. But in the hero story, typically the hero will adopt some of the virtues of the opposite, but the opposite can be a more static character in a hero journey.
Because he has to learn and grow and become a more open-minded PC individual.
It's Paul Abdul and MC Scat Cat. Opposites attract.
One step forward, two steps back, my friend.
So there's...
Whatever happened to MC Scat Cat?
There's the trickster.
If I could Rickroll you in the middle of a podcast, I'd do it right here.
You know how much I love to be Rickrolled. I think that's the best thing to happen in the net in 2007. If I had a vote and a reward, I love it. I watched it all the way through every time.
Really? Okay. Go on, Tex.
Okay. There's the trickster, which is also typically a party member. Although sometimes in JRPGs, this is not a party member, but it's someone who shows up but gives guidance through riddles or obscure clues.
Some people would say
sometimes this can be the
hero's
sidekick.
Entire JRPG genre as a whole. Sorry, Tex. I'd say.
Someone would be you. Continue, Tex.
What about the D&D cartoon, The Dungeon Master?
The trickster, sometimes as a party member, can also provide comic relief.
The monkey.
Okay. Then there's the Threshold Guardian. And the Threshold Guardian is typically a character that will block the hero's path, but provide the hero a test or a challenge. Now, the Threshold Guardian is not necessarily the bad guy or not even necessarily a bad guy, although it could be like an underling. It could be a lower level bad guy. It could even be a neutral force that just has to block the character's or the hero's path until the hero's grown enough.
Never ending story. Yep. They had a whole bunch of them in there.
Okay.
And of course, there's always the dad who does not understand his son and this whole role playing thing. So he says, you can't go play with that group anymore, son. Your friend's in the basement.
Anyway, there's the Harold character. The Harold
is he always named Harold or just in Joseph Campbell's version?
H-E-R-A-L-D.
Oh, so not the guy who lives with the Hendersons.
Anyway, that's the character that shows up. And typically, this is not a party member. This is typically someone who brings in knowledge from the outside. Someone who shows up with a news flash or an announcement.
This is Fear the Boot.
Tex, I got to say, I'm impressed. Did you actually read this book?
Yeah.
Oh, because usually on Fear the Boot, I mean, the point is to show up here with half-formed opinions based on vague research. And
the book is Hero of a Thousand Faces or Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Well, supposedly, right? Since this is the first episode where I was actually going to be somewhat moderating, I decided to go do some homework. So I haven't actually read Joseph Campbell's book, but I've probably read about
you read the Wikipedia
50
article?
To 70 pages of this on basic storytelling archetypes, both plot points, plot arcs, elements. Story types and also characters.
Tex, let me go ahead. If you haven't realized it yet, the more work you put into researching a topic that you bring forth to Dan, the more he's going to steer you directly away from whatever you research. It happens every time, and it still works, so I have no complaints. But with the World of Darkness episode, I had so much, and we went a completely different direction. I'm like, hey, it was still a good episode. I'm happy.
All right, Tex, go on. Do you have a couple more for us here? Just
there's a few more.
I don't want to torture this too far, but do you have a couple more big ones you can throw out at us?
Okay, so a couple more big ones are typically the scoundrel. And the scoundrel can be a variant of the opposite, especially if your hero is a real straight-laced, goody-two-shoes, lawful good type character. Then a chaotic good type character a la Han Solo.
Yeah, I was going to say Han Solo comes to mind.
Right. So Han Solo was the case of the scoundrel or the lawful good. Although to a degree, he also served the point of the opposite. That because Luke was young and naive and uptight and kind of a goody two shoes.
And incestuous.
You beat me to it.
All right.
Yeah, I wasn't going
Lucas
there.
In love.
All right. Go on, Tex. Give us one or two more.
Okay, and another one can be the damsel in distress type character, and the character doesn't necessarily have to be female, but it's someone who needs help or needs rescuing. However, oftentimes if that character is introduced earlier in the story, then that character can also join the party.
Let's take this back to the relevance to a role-playing game, in that I think because that's where I want to bring this back to, because the storytelling archetypes are, you know, interesting, but in and of themselves don't necessarily serve the point of this podcast.
Wank, 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 wank.
And so I want to take this back to the relevance to role-playing game, that I completely agree with what was said earlier, that this general outline of a story can serve as a great starting place for creating a background of a character, or even creating a general outline for a campaign, but also the archetypes here that Tex just gave can serve as a good starting point for writing up your NPCs that they're going to encounter along the way. Now, I don't think you can stop there. I don't think you can say, well, we're going to have a scoundrel, period, because I think that's really not much of an NPC or not much of a character. But you can still say that, look, I want someone who's going to serve as a counterbalance to the party. And so you start to look over your party, which, you know, you're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 players, and you start to find some kind of a trend in them that, you know, they're too chaotic or whatever. So you kind of put them in with someone who's more of a straight-laced scolding type.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that the scoundrel is typically used when the character is young and naive and virtuous. But if you've got a party full of scoundrels, you could have their opposite show up and be a nun.
Right.
And the nun could be the quote-unquote scoundrel character to the group of thieves.
And the point being that each of these archetypes...
Kung Fu fighting nun. Who's a ninja?
Each of these archetypes can serve as a great starting point, not a finishing point, but a starting point for an NPC, simply to either A, serve a purpose within your general campaign or plot, or B, to create really these great role-playing opportunities. Because, like I said, if you've got a party of scoundrels, you introduce the straight-laced person, right there, you have just invited a ton of interesting role-playing situations or conflicts that can arise throughout the course of the game. Let's even move off of conflict. Let's move back to the mentor. If the characters are just completely lost or just aren't getting through it, you know, they're completely off the beaten path. I'm not a fan of railroading, but you could have the mentor show up to kind of give them some advice that might get them back in the direction you had in mind.
Here are these lightsabers.
Right, or
they belong
to your
fathers.
Also a trickster or a herald character too, because a herald could either show up and give them a news flash, or the trickster could show up and give them riddles that point them in the right direction too.
Why is newsflash funny, Luke?
No, it's Harold. Every time he says it, I keep thinking of some dude named Harold showing up to give him stuff. I'm sorry.
Well, one other
thing, long day.
You can use these different archetypes for is
characters
to fill
are,
out your
If your
world.
Players are stuck or if your players are in a rut, there's these different ways, these different things that you could use to give them a push. And the cool thing is the mentor may or may not be in the party, but the trickster and the herald typically aren't at all.
Right. And you know what I mean?
And you could have them kind of show up and give the characters a little nudge if they need it, and then leave again.
Yeah, I think really here, the ultimate point that I would like to kind of sign this out on is the fact that role-playing games really are an act of storytelling. And this is where I would come in complete agreement. We've mentioned Mick Bradley several times, where I would come in complete agreement with some other podcasts that if you look at role-playing games, they really are just an extension of the art of storytelling, with the one, I really maybe two differences from traditional storytelling, which is the fact that, first of all, it's interactive. The people that you're telling the story to suddenly have say in the story. And secondly, you have random decision makers that a die or dice or a pack of cards or whatever it is in that game suddenly may diverge the story in ways you never expected. But really, role-playing games are fundamentally an act of the tradition of storytelling. And so I think that if we look at the traditions of storytelling, you can find a lot of great starting points for your plots or a lot of great elements to add in for your plots or characters. So I think what I'm going to do, Tex, I'm actually going to look up this book you're referring to, and I may link it just like off Amazon or something in our show notes, just in case anyone's interested in reading this, because by mastering these sort of theories of storytelling, you don't want to become too pedantic or too railroading or any of these things. But I think really these can serve as great points of inspiration or great starting points for the games that you're trying to run and the NPCs you're trying to bring in and the worlds that you're trying to build.
Yep. Well, if you wanted the bibliography, the book is called The Hero with 1,000 Faces. And he also did a television show called The Power of Myth.
Oh, I did not know he had a television show.
One other thing about this.
Joseph Campbell does not have a television show. He's dead, I think.
This whole analysis thing is if you go back and look at what you've been doing with your various games, you might want to see some, you might notice some similarities you hadn't noticed before, and maybe you want to take it in a little bit different direction.
Yeah, we've talked about player ruts before, and you know what? Game masters have ruts too, where all their stories start to look too similar.
Hello, it's Captain Nepic again.
Yeah. And that works okay when you bounce groups a lot like I do, but if you are with the same group for a long period of time, game master ruts become just as predictable and just as bad as player ruts, The one guy that always plays the thief is no less annoying than the one game master that always runs plot X.
Well, right, and that's why it's important to react to your characters. For example, if you needed to provide an opposite character, the opposite to Shrek is going to be very different than the opposite to Nemo, which is going to be very different to the opposite of Alice from Alice in Wonderland, which is going to be very different to the opposite of Luke Skywalker or Dorothy in The Wizard of
Oz. That's a very unbalanced party, and they're not going to make it very far.
Well, it depends on which Nemo. Are we talking about the fish Nemo or Captain Nemo?
I assume the fish.
Yeah, the fish from Finding Nemo.
Okay, if it was the captain, I think we have our tank, but otherwise...
All right. Well, I think this has given us definitely some stuff to think about for next time. And Tex, I want to thank you for doing all this research. That's really not generally a part of the Fear the Boot formula. We're supposed to have half-formed opinions that just, you know, get belligerent about them. But as for the rest of you guys, we will catch you next time.
Love you, Harold.
Bye.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2008, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.